This is the Takeaway Podcast for May 4th, 2016.
It's been some unbelievable day and evening and year, and never have been through anything like this, but it's a beautiful thing to behold.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And can you hear it? Can you hear it there? Yeah. Here they come. They're marching. All of those Republicans who are now going to have to try and find a way somehow to march together.
Guys, we have a con artist as the front runner in the Republican Party.
Whoever you are that think you're going to support Donald Trump, think, do you believe in the Constitution?
Donald Trump is a jerk.
To rebuild the bridges to the man they have said some things that they may now regret.
The screenwriter says that he based the character Biff Tannen on Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is not going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. If he is, that's the end of the Republican Party.
All together now, building a bridge back to Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump.
Mr. Trump.
Yes, Donald Trump is now the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party for President of the United States. That's quite a Trump steak mouthful there. With an Indiana primary landslide victory, there is no more delegate math to do. Ted Cruz got out last night. John Kasich apparently has a few extra T-shirts to sell. He's technically still in the race, but has no way of challenging Trump at this point in delegates. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' win in Indiana can't stop Hillary Clinton's delegate machine, but it once again points up her weakness as a national candidate. More about that later. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is with me. It's Trump versus Bernie Clinton, Clinton-Bernie. The race starts now, right?
It sure does. And there's a reckoning going on, as you just described, John, among Republicans, many of them coming to terms with the man who is going to be their nominee, who many of them said they wouldn't vote for, couldn't vote for, or a year ago laughed at, couldn't conceive of to be the party's nominee. Now, you just played a lot of other people's words about Donald Trump, that he's a jerk, that he doesn't believe in the Constitution, all of those other things. It was great to play those because I've been talking to some people about Donald Trump's own words, some of the things that he said during this primary and what it means now as Trump transitions to a general election to try to be a president and to try to appear presidential and how he makes that transition starting this morning, John. I talked to a well-known political Republican operative in Washington, D.C. His name is Josh Holmes. He's the founding partner of Cavalry Group. He's run one or two campaigns in his day. And he has talked about what Donald Trump has been saying about Latinos, what he's been saying about Muslims, and especially what he's been saying about women.
Voters are so skeptical of any messages that are filtered through the media at this stage that they tend not to trust what it is that people are saying that these people stand for. It is a much different scenario when they are telling you directly what it is that they stand for. And in that sense, that's the reason why that a first person, your own words, are so damaging in general elections.
And John, that's why people like Josh Holmes expect to hear a lot of ads during this general that are like this.
Real quotes from Donald Trump about women.
Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
It really doesn't matter what they write, as long as you've got a young and beautiful piece of ass. This is how Donald Trump talks about our mothers,
our sisters,
our daughters.
Where did you get that?
John, that is a Republican-funded attack ad from the primary, funded by a Republican super PAC against Donald Trump. And if you think the Republican one was bad, these people are warning me, wait until Hillary Clinton and the Democrats start to produce those.
But they're going to have to put those into the deep freeze, right? They've paid for the ads, but they can't run them now, right?
Well, it might be a little bit early, but they're certainly going to be able to run them later in the election. And then part of the question becomes, how does Donald Trump respond to this long history of his own words? He's shown a remarkable ability to change himself, to sort of stretch with the political times. And that's amazed a lot of political operatives. Ron Bongean is an experienced political hand. He's worked for leaders in the House and Senate. He has his own political consulting firm in Washington. And I put this question of Trump's own words to him yesterday.
But I could see him standing in front of Planned Parenthood in August saying to the country, you see, I told you they do a lot of great things here. at Planned Parenthood. And I'm really supportive of them. Sure, we have an issue over what they've been doing on the abortion thing, but I kind of love these guys. And then most Americans are not paying attention to the daily political scene start gravitating to that conversation and begin to believe him. I think he's a chameleon and can morph.
So is he saying that it doesn't matter what Trump said or that it will come back to haunt him, what Trump said?
Neither. He's saying it can matter a great deal, but that Trump has shown a remarkable ability to shift and change from past positions and past identities and may be able to make voters forget all of the awful things that he said in the past or all of the awful things that he said in the primary.
It's also the case that everybody has to come back under the tent. I mean, they all have to come back to Cleveland smiling. I mean, there may be some bitter folks and some fundraisers who stay home, but come on. I mean, they're all going to be – the 17 are going to be together.
John, there are some Republicans around my neighborhood in Washington, some who've resigned themselves, they say, to the fact that they're going to lose this election because they think Trump is weak and too many of them can't or won't rally around him. But that's only a few. You know what they also realize? That Hillary Clinton is fundamentally a weak candidate, that her ceiling is pretty low. These are two extremely unpopular candidates when you really look at it. What happens when they go head to head? There may actually be great opportunities for Donald Trump. And strategically, you know, a lot of Republicans, even the ones who complain, like you're saying, they would never vote for Trump, you know where they're looking? They're looking to the Rust Belt. They're looking to states like Ohio and Wisconsin, maybe Pennsylvania, but especially Michigan, the places that are disaffected, where workers are sick of trade deals, are worried about their future, and are afraid, people who Donald Trump has really appealed to. I had a fascinating conversation with Debbie Dingell. She's a member of Congress, a Democrat, and a big Hillary supporter from Detroit and Dearborn and Ypsilanti in Michigan. She has been going around to the Clinton campaign and to any Democrat who will listen to say, don't take Donald Trump lightly. This is Michigan, and I'm telling you, he can win. Listen.
I've been saying this, and I'm just telling what I see in Michigan. I said it before the primary that I didn't agree with anybody who thought that this race was not going to be close in Michigan. And I'm telling people now that if we don't do a better job communicating with working men and women, we're going to have a problem.
Is the mission for the GOP to focus on Congress if they don't like Donald Trump?
Well, there's a lot of Republican money that's probably not going to go to Donald Trump, including Coke money, John. That's unlikely to go to Donald Trump. Where does that money then go? It could go down ballot, and they're going to need it. A lot of Republican candidates are really worried about the top of the ticket, and I think that you're about to see a whole bunch of Republican Senate campaigns in places like New Hampshire, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin that are all of a sudden independent campaigns, running their own campaigns. Mitch McConnell famously told Republican incumbents, if Donald Trump is the nominee, we're going to drop him like a hot rock. What does that mean? Run your own race. Don't run a Trump coattails campaign. Do what you can to stay in the Senate, John.
We shall see. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
My pleasure.
Now, here's a wager you might have loved to have made. $36 million, a bet on Donald Trump, $36 million bet on Trump, would have paid you just about $67 million in wealthy high roller bets against the Donald during this campaign season. That's what anti-Trump groups have spent on 53,000 ads. As of last month, Trump has spent far less of his own money, that $36 million, on his own campaign. Sean Noble is a Republican strategist who joins me from Phoenix. Sean, is that money all down the drain now?
It is. It is, in fact, the way politics works. When you lose, the investment goes away. There is no return on investment.
And how does that sting of losing all that money bear on the ability of some of these influential Republicans to get back into the tent in time for the convention and for the general election?
What we've seen in the last few hours, essentially, since Trump has become the presumptive nominee when Ted Cruz dropped out last night, is you've seen some people in the kind of the Never Trump movement beginning to double down, essentially saying, this movement's not over. We're going to continue to tell the truth about Donald Trump. Anything that they do, if they get any kind of traction, that's only going to hurt Trump and make it more likely that Hillary gets elected. So there's going to have to be some soul searching within the Republican Party among activists, the donor class, and the grassroots, because as much as some don't appreciate it and are horrified by it. He is the presumptive nominee, and he's going to be the Republican Party standard bearer in the fall.
How do Republicans conduct this conversation? What discussions have you had with people who may have been in the never camp and either are considering doubling down or considering basically building a bridge and wandering back into the tent?
Well, I don't doubt that there are those in the Trump campaign that have been flooded with phone calls, emails, and texts from operatives across the country who have been anti-Trump and now say, oh, he's the nominee, I got to get on board. A lot of that's going to be for selfish reasons. They now want to be paid by the Trump campaign to help them in the general. The grassroots, there's enough dislike for Hillary that they're just going to say Trump's our guy. And some in the donor community, I think, they may not support Trump, but what their thought process will be is, what do we have to do to protect the House and the Senate to make sure that we have a Republican House and Senate, because they believe Trump will lose to Hillary, and so we need to have a check against Hillary, and they don't want to have a situation like we saw in 2008 where you have a Democrat president, a Democrat House, and a Democrat Senate.
Is that the Koch brothers' logic in possibly supporting Hillary or even, you know, sending up that balloon?
I think that when Charles was asked the question about would Hillary make a better president than some of the Republican potentials, and he said probably. I mean, I don't think that that's untrue in the sense that she understands a lot more about the inner workings of government and how the process works. The fact is that there's going to be renewed interest and a heavy investment in Republican efforts for the House and the Senate because of President Clinton is going to be a challenge to the values and the ideologies and the issues that, you know, Republican donors care about.
So it's there are interesting episodes to come here in this campaign, wouldn't you say?
No question. I mean, this has been the most bizarre election cycle I've ever watched, and I think it's just starting.
Sean Noble, Republican strategist, speaking from Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks so much, Sean.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus is in the Donald Trump tent. He tweeted, Trump will be presumptive GOP nominee. We all need to unite and focus on defeating Hillary Clinton. Hashtag never Clinton. We've been hearing from you on Facebook. Ken Pelosi wrote to us, maybe the Republican Party needs to drop to the depths in order to realize their obstructionist policies have destroyed the party. All in all, the Republicans may actually deserve Trump, says Ken. Wanda Zodro says, this guarantees a Democratic win. We'll see. Will Thornton says, Trump's being the presumptive Republican nominee. Remember, the lesser of two evils is still evil. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Is this a confusing moment for Democrats with the Bernie Sanders victory in Indiana? Or is this a case of the Hillary Clinton delegate machine relentlessly moving ahead? 92 delegates were at stake in Indiana. Anna Greenberg, Democratic strategist and senior vice president at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research, does not even have to think about that one.
I think we're in the mode of relentless push. Hillary Clinton made a decision that she was not going to win Indiana. It's not a state that's particularly hospitable towards her. It's got a significant white blue-collar Democratic base, a group that she doesn't do well with. And also, it's an open primary, so independents vote. And Sanders has been winning about 75% of independent voters in most primaries. And so the win netted him about 5 delegates, barely made a dent.
It appears as though Hillary is going to have some trouble in some of the same states that Barack Obama won based on results like these. Would you agree?
Well, I don't think the Democratic primary is necessarily predictive of what's going to happen in the general election. And Obama lost Indiana in 2012. So I think it's basically a red state by some, though the stars aligned and Obama won it in 2008, but I think it's reverted back to its general red state status. Hillary Clinton's going to lose West Virginia also, but that is a state that right now in the polls, Trump is up by, 25 points over Clinton. And it's a state that, Democrats haven't won since Bill Clinton.
What does Bernie Sanders signify at this point? He would say it's a movement within the Democratic Party that they need to account for in some way, if not now, then at the convention. And others would say that Bernie Sanders' victory in Indiana continues to weaken Hillary incrementally, even though she's going to get the delegate count.
I don't think it weakens her because she's basically turned to the general election. And with Cruz's shocking dropping out yesterday, it makes it even easier for her to focus on Trump and just focus on the general election. And certainly Trump is going to focus on Hillary Clinton. So in some ways, what happens is Sanders gets ignored as this becomes a general election contest. I don't know exactly why he's staying into the end. He obviously has every right to do that. And certainly Hillary Clinton stayed in until June when she ran against Barack Obama in 2008. So there's no precedent for Hillary Clinton to suggest that he should drop out. But I think at this point, the race is very much going to turn to the general election. I mean, Cruz dropping out yesterday really, in some ways, helped Clinton make the following few months as the primary season ends really about the general election, not about the primary anymore.
What do you think the future is for Sanders supporters, and what does the Democratic Party have to do to keep them from staying home in November?
Well, I mean, I think you have to distinguish between the independents who voted for Sanders and the Democrats who voted for Sanders. There's no question in my mind, if you're a registered Democrat and vote in primaries, you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton in the general election. I think it's those independents who came out to vote in open primaries who may decide now it doesn't matter who the president is if you've got these two folks running.
But isn't it incumbent upon Hillary Clinton to declare some sort of positive message, some reason to vote for her, excitement to vote for her that's going to motivate people outside of her base, people who have been with her for decades?
Of course she has to make the positive case for herself. And I would argue that it's been difficult for her to do that in the context of a primary season completely dominated by Trump. I mean, if you look at when people self-report what they've been hearing about, it's Trump, 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 right? And so Hillary Clinton, has been defined really since last summer when she decided to run by Clinton Foundation donations and email and Benghazi and, and then an unexpectedly strong showing by Bernie Sanders. She really hasn't had much chance to make the positive case for herself. When you're in the context of a general election where all the attention is on the D versus R, she will get her opportunity to make the case for herself. And she will do it not just in paid advertising, but I think things like debates will be very clarifying. I think conventions will be very clarifying. That positive case for herself is really been difficult for her to make in the context of a primary, and I think she will and can and will make it in the general election.
Last issue, will there be a dust up over the rules regarding superdelegates at the convention, and that some will have to stand down and give Bernie Sanders a chance to compete with Hillary on purely pledged delegates?
Well, I don't think so. She's leading in pledged delegates. I mean, the case against Sanders is pretty strong. She's leading in votes, she's leading in pledged delegates, and she's leading in superdelegates. I mean, there's no measure on which he could contest her lead. I think there'll be very little patience for that. And frankly, Sanders himself has not shown a huge appetite for a kind of vicious fight with Hillary Clinton. A lot of people around him are much more hostile. And he really did sort of attack her until towards the end of the campaign. And even then, it's nothing compared to what's happening on the Republican side. I think Bernie Sanders' instinct is not to tear people down, unlike, say, Donald Trump.
Anna Greenberg, Democratic strategist and senior vice president at Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. She spoke from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you.
When cities fail in their basic responsibilities, there are multiple costs. And in the case of young people, the greatest cost may be a sense that no one cares about them.
Mr. President, hello, my name is Mari Copeny and I'm 8 years old. I live in Flint, Michigan, and I am more commonly known around town as Little Miss Flint. I am one of the children that is affected by this water, and I have been doing my best to march and protest and speak up for all the kids that live here in Flint. I would love for a chance to meet you or your wife. My mom said chances are you will be too busy.
Little Mari Kopeny wasn't able to meet with the president earlier this year when she was in Washington, D.C., but the president is in Flint today and will visit Mari and city and state officials, including embattled Republican Governor Snyder. What community activists are noticing now are psychological consequences in Flint of a sudden degradation of water, a cover-up, a toxic health threat, building now into deep trust issues and constant vigilance and anxiety about where the next threat is coming from. Dr. Kent Key is a Flint native and is seeing this exactly. He's a community engagement researcher for the Michigan Institute for Clinical Health and Research at the University of Michigan. And mental health crisis worker Elizabeth Birch is a licensed master social worker with Genesee Health System in Flint. She says there is a clear Flint water crisis pathology now.
I think that because this problem has been going on for so long and residents were really voicing their concerns from the beginning, but unfortunately there was not any elected officials that could do anything about it. And this problem has been going on for years now. Folks have just really felt out of control and the level of stress and anxiety in their lives has really increased.
Dr. Key, I mean, this is an abrogation of an essential responsibility of government to keep people safe. That's what we're seeing here in the mental health consequences, right?
Well, what I'm seeing is there's so many different levels of distrust now. There's levels of water insecurity. There are levels of issues of confidence. And when we talk about this levels of distrust, it's very clear to make a distinction between that of a natural disaster and that of a man-made disaster. When a disaster happens in a natural sense, such as a tornado or earthquake, there is a level of resolve that you come to because it's kind of unavoidable. But when it's a man-made disaster, specifically one that has been led by elected officials, if you will, then there's a whole nother level of psychological trauma that happens because these are people who you have put your trust in, who you have put your confidence in, that are supposed to protect you. And when that doesn't happen, it exacerbates the already existing stressors that you live in an urban environment, and specifically in a city where there is high economic decline.
Dr. Key, is it also the case that when those elected officials don't disclose what's going on and hide the issue for a while, you also have no, unlike a natural disaster, you have no idea where it's coming from.
Exactly. And then you don't know who to trust, the very ones in government that the community is looking at that caused the problem. Now we're supposed to depend on these exact same entities to help guide us out of it. So it creates this level of stress that is kind of beyond belief.
Elizabeth Birch, I want to make sure that people listening don't consider this some kind of story of, you know, unfortunate people who are, whining about something. This, you know, when government keeps people from feeling safe, there are all kinds of health problems, and mental health problems are really right at the top. What are you seeing, and what particular stories can you tell me?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we hear over and over is that this is really impacting people in every single aspect of their life. So not only is it, I have to go out of my way to get water, but it's problems with bathing, problems with, I can't exercise as much as I want to because I can't shower at my own house. I have to go outside of town to shower. I mean, it really is impacting folks at every single part of their life. And additionally, to say that people are just whining is just a little bit absurd. I mean, parents are worried about their child's development. We have adults who are worried about how this is going to impact them. I mean, the unknown in this crisis is astronomical, and it's heartbreaking.
How do we control the anxiety? How do we treat the anxiety in a way that allows people, and it's going to be people that are going to have to pull themselves out of this, to go about being productive?
Absolutely. I mean, it's always important to have a listening ear and someone who's not going to minimize this crisis, someone who's going to understand and empathize with what folks are going through because it's intense.
Dr. Key, the presence of President Obama in the community could have some palliative impact, wouldn't you say?
I would say the fact that he's coming may kind of give people a sense of hope. However, specifically for the African-American community, because he's the first African-American president, it still is a struggle with the cultural and historical pathology of the African-American experience, because this issue in Flint has resurrected for many the wounds of Tuskegee and many of the elders in our community that have taught many of us, because I'm in my 30s, so I didn't really live during that time where they were actually doing the experiment. However, it's kind of putting a face to all of the stories that I've heard at my family reunions about the Tuskegee experiment. So I'm hoping that the president's visit can help in a way kind of soothe and kind of re-energize the people to fight through this, specifically for all the community, but more specifically for the African-American community in Flint.
Dr. Kent Key, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We also spoke with Elizabeth Birch. Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Birch is a licensed master in social work with Genesee Health System, and Dr. Kent Key is a community engagement researcher for the Michigan Institute for Clinical Health and Research at the University of Michigan, and executive deputy director of community-based organization Partners. Earlier this week, we looked at a tangible reminder of this country's brutal and violent racial history still standing in a rural county in Mississippi, a rusting bridge where six people were lynched in the last century, a silent but visible testimony to events of the past that have a legacy in the present. There is a widespread expectation of racial tension, suspicion, prejudice, or acting out of anger in American life. What hasn't been resolved explicitly in this country as a way of expressing itself in other ways. A 2015 study from the American Psychological Association linked discrimination, what it calls microaggression and anticipation of racism, in more than 3,300 individuals with heightened stress levels and mental illness. The study concluded that about half of adults in the U.S. would report they've experienced discrimination, unfair treatment from the police, neighbors, or being treated unfairly when receiving health care. Monica Williams is a psychologist, a professor, and the director of the University of Louisville's Center for Mental Health Disparities. She says that a patient being treated for PTSD showed her the seriousness of racially generated stress.
She had been a very high-functioning professional woman who worked at a large corporation, the name you would recognize if I said it, where she did trainings all over the world for international computer security, and she had two master's degrees and was very competent, very professional, very smart. And when I saw her in my office, she had been completely reduced to disabled as a result of what had happened to her on the job. It was a striking contrast to who she had been to the person she was at that moment, where she couldn't even get out of the house. She couldn't even walk her dog or make food for herself because of the racist experiences that she had encountered on the job.
How did racism in this particular case trigger something that I'm presuming this woman assumed she was immune from because she had all these credentials, she was so successful?
Exactly. She had encountered racism many times in her life and navigated it very successfully. And, you know, and this happened to her when she was traveling. She was out of the country. These were things that were said to her, racist, threatening things said to her by another coworker. At a time, she felt very vulnerable, and she worried that no one would be there to come to her aid if he did something to her. And when she went back to her employer about what had happened, they failed to take proper steps to ensure her safety on the job. So she started to think that no one would look out for her safety and well-being. And that was when she really had this sharp decline.
As a psychologist, what is the particular vulnerability of someone in a situation like this to feel alone and unsupported, even though HR procedures are ostensibly designed to protect everybody in the workplace?
Right. Well, she dealt with some ridicule and disbelief when she tried to talk to HR about what had happened. Additionally, I don't know if you watch the news, but law enforcement, which is supposed to be there to protect us, they're out there shooting unarmed black men. So those of us in the African-American community, we can't count on them to keep us safe when bad things happen or when people threaten us.
So psychologically speaking, there is a dormant sense of vulnerability that can be triggered in a workplace where there would be no firearms and no police simply by virtue of the fact that a racist incident on the job conflates all of the vulnerabilities of African Americans that have been so dominant in the news stories in America over the last 2 years.
Absolutely. And when we think about PTSD and trauma, we're often just looking for an individual event. But it's important to recognize that the African American community is suffering from historical trauma, cultural trauma, and community trauma. And that's all layered on top of these individual incidents. So that when one thing like this happens, it's not just one thing. It's accumulation of things that have been weighing on a person ever since they were born and had any recognition of race or who they are in society.
Well, that raises a question of how big is this from a clinical perspective? Because I'm wondering if there's a way of distinguishing between the stress of someone who encounters the nasty kind of discrimination that we've been talking about here in the workplace versus, say, a young black male oldest son who feels in a Ivy League school, for instance, extraordinary pressure to succeed because of some of the same racial issues, but it manifests itself completely differently. Can we distinguish those? Are they part of the same thing? As a psychologist, how would you look at that?
I think they are part of the same thing because there are so many pressures and stresses on African Americans, for example, not to live up to all of the negative stereotypes about us. And at the same time, we're receiving messages everywhere from the media and people who are overtly racist and people who are non-racist who say and do things that continue to reinforce the idea that we're less than. These things do accumulate. They're cumulative. And so what we often see is that African Americans who are successful, who are well-educated, who are having high-profile, successful careers, they are often experiencing more of these small racist events or microaggressions, as you will. And we see that this is connected even more strongly to outcomes like depression and anxiety.
If this is important, and you've advocated for this to be included in the DSM, the Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, so that individuals who have these kinds of problems can get medical attention and deal with it on a clinical basis. If that were to be the case, do you think every psychologist, black or white, could equally treat and counsel someone with this kind of a situation?
I think it's possible. I think right now we're not in a position to do that. But the greater awareness that would come from including this in the DSM would absolutely spur more training, more research, more education in how to understand and address this problem in clients and patients. So I think it would be invaluable. And I do believe that we as a field, as psychology, would step up to the plate and really do better in training people who are coming along to be able to help people with these problems.
As a professor and as a psychologist, how much tension do you feel, if we could elaborate on that for a moment, between the impulse to defend as a parent and the impulse to counsel and relieve stress, to essentially find some accommodation so that we're not always going into situations as blacks and whites and going, okay, who's mad? Who's angry? Who's going to pop off here?
Yeah, I do a lot of diversity trainings, and these diversity trainings have a tendency to become very contentious. So one of the things that I really work hard to do is create a space of safety for everyone involved. And it's really challenging, but I think it's really important because people can't move forward as long as they're angry and defending their position. They have to be able to sit back and empathize and connect with another person and take their perspective. So I think that's critical, and that's kind of the cornerstone of all of the trainings that I do.
Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Monica Williams is a psychologist, a professor, and the director of the University of Louisville's Center for Mental Health Disparities. Here's something to take with you today. The rise of Donald Trump from Saturday Night Live joke and fringe candidate to Saturday Night Live joke and presumptive Republican nominee for president took everyone by surprise. But I got to give credit. Last year, I was at a group of station people, fundraisers, and political pundits, and I asked the audience who thought Donald Trump would get out of the race and when. Everybody called out a month. They were sure Trump would fold his campaign. I then asked who believed Trump would still be in by convention time. One person raised his hand.
I'm Ira Flatow.
Mr. Science, Ira Flatow, the host of Science Friday for 25 years. He emailed me last night and asked if you won a prize. This is your prize, Ira. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.